And no cursing, right?
Yeah. Now you can say damn.
Well, okay. Wait a minute.
You know, just not nothing that the FCC is going to yank us off the air for.
Okay.
I don't care. And I'm always,
and you edit it.
Yeah, and I'm always happy to bleep you.
Yeah.
I bleep, love it when I get to bleep someone. All right. And it's Strother.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's start with the ever-popular life story. Where you born, you know, where you lived, where'd you go to school, whatever.
Wow. Well, I was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Greensboro.
Oh, wow. So, wow, we're Tar Heels.
We're Tar Heels.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Stayed there for, I moved away from Winston-Salem when I was about 13.
Okay.
And then moved to Boston and then stayed there for about 10 years and then moved here to Virginia.
Okay. And where in Virginia?
Waynesboro, Virginia.
And what brought you to Waynesboro?
My husband. He wasn't my husband then. He was my boyfriend at the time. And we were in our early 20s, basically. Mm-hmm. I was 21. He was 22. And we moved from Boston here to Waynesboro, Virginia.
Okay. Did you miss Boston?
A little bit. Boston was kind of hard for me.
Because?
Well, I lived in North Carolina with my grandmother for a while. Till I, again, like I said, I was 13, and I was a kind of antsy child. And my grandmother was elderly. She raised me primarily, and my mother lived in Boston. And so I got a little too antsy, and I went to Boston to live with my mother, who I had never lived with for some time before, basically. And so I ended up there, and I stayed with her all of 6 months, and she put me out. Get out. Hit
at
the street.
13 and a half?
Yeah, about 13 and a half. Mm-hmm. That was it.
All right. And so what'd you do? How'd you cope?
First of all, you got to find a place to stay, Martha. Mm-hmm. And that's basically it. You know, working to find a place to stay. I was considered at that time, the term was throwaway. And so that's how I was deemed between the ages of 13 to 17. And so I lived on the streets, did some couch surfing, lived in group homes, foster homes. As a result, I had dropped out of school when I was in the eighth grade. I finished the eighth grade and just really managed to make it off of the streets, specifically a Catholic nonprofit organization called Bridge Over Troubled Waters helped me off the streets, basically. I found myself pregnant, and I figured, wow, it's time to settle down. I don't want to raise a child in this environment. I need to find something permanent.
So you were going to raise your child?
Oh, yes. I did raise my child.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Even though your mother didn't raise you.
That's right.
Does that have something to do with it?
Oh, yes. Definitely. You know, because I was living the life of a child not being raised by its parent. And so I knew directly the ramifications of that, and I did not want to have my own child suffer that. And so once I discovered that I was pregnant, I actually went and made efforts and said, hey, I'm pregnant. I need to get off the street. I need something permanent. And that was the only place that really helped me. Hmm. So that was my starting point.
Did they take you in, give you a place to live?
They did. They took me in. Bridge is very prominent in the community for at-risk youth. Mm-hmm. And so they had been doing it since 1970, helping youth on the streets of Boston with medical care, dentistry, getting them off of the streets. And so at this particular time, I went into a group home in Brighton, Massachusetts, and stayed there till I had my baby. And before I had her, I got my GED because, again, I had dropped out of school. I finished, completed the eighth grade, got my GED, and then just started moving forth from there, you know, learning how to shop and doing all of those things that a parent should have taught me.
I want to ask about what was going on inside you from 13 to 17. Were you scared? Were you lonely? Were you mad?
I would say all of those, but you can't, as far as scared or fear, you can't look like you're scared because you'll be chewed up and spit out. You have to put on a coat of armor. And that was one of the things, one of the counselors at the time, he was a white Italian guy, Daniel Buddy Henderson. And he was a counselor there. He was the guy that you had to go through to get into the buddy house. They called it the buddy house. And you had to sit down for an interview with him. And we talked years later, and he said, Lori, you were the biggest bitch. He said, you had a chip on your shoulder this big. And I said, yeah, I did. Had to. You know, you have to have a chip on your shoulder. But man, I went to him and he saw that I was literally asking him for help. And I was. It was hard for me. But hey, dude, I'm in this situation. I need to come off of the streets. I need to find a permanent home. I need to stop couch surfing. I have a child to raise.
You're a woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make any difference? This is in the 80s?
In the 80s, early 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did that make life any difference in life on the street as a teenager?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. There were all kinds of, I met all kinds of children because that's what we were. We were children that all met up together. I stayed in group homes and I saw white, I saw black, I saw Latino, I saw African, I saw...
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody.
Okay, you were just homeless.
Yeah, homeless. Didn't have a permanent place to stay, yeah.
When did you start singing?
I've been singing forever, Martha. Forever. I did not start singing formally, and what I mean by formally, in a group, until I moved to Virginia.
Okay.
After I graduated the Bridge House, I actually got myself an apartment, and I started going to college because, again, I got my GED. So I started majored in music at UMass Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there for all of 1 year. Because my idea of music at the time was rhythm and blues. And so a formal program like UMass Boston, their idea of music is something else. Mozart, Bach, Gregorian chant, all of those things.
Classical.
Yes. But that is where I discovered the blues, right there at UMass Boston in a listening experience class. And specifically, it was a tape that had, again, the Gregorian chant and all of these different types of music. And on this CD, was not a CD at the time, excuse me.
Whatever it
cassette
was.
Cassette tape. On this cassette tape.
Eight track.
Was Bessie Smith singing Empty Bed Blues, Part 1 and 2.
You sing that?
No, I don't formally sing that, but that is what really rocked my world right there.
Now, when you say that, rocked my world, you're listening, what happened?
Her voice.
Her voice. And what about her voice?
Big, powerful, and then the lyrics. Very sassy, metaphoric, kind of risque. And it's like, wow, I like this, you know?
Yep.
You know, because that wasn't what I was accustomed to. I grew up as a child of rhythm and blues, listening to Gladys Knight and Earth, Wind, and Fire and those types of artists during the daytime, because during the daytime, it was the AM stations that we listened to. In Winston-Salem, it was WAAA, and that was the black radio station. And you would listen to that from sun up. It would come on sun up, and it would go off the air sundown. And so that's what I would listen to. And then after that station went off, I would go out to the FM world or white radio stations and listen to Rod Stewart and the Eagles and all of the pop top 40 music of the time. So I was really into music. basically.
Did it speak to you in ways that other things didn't, or did it wake something up or go to a part of you? You know, why?
I think music is a part of me. Like I said, I think I came out the chute of singing. I have no idea when I started singing because it's just something that has always come very natural to me. And I think my grandmother recognized that. She bought me when I turned 9 something called, we referred to as a component set. And basically what that was a turntable with a radio, and it had 2 speakers included. And so it was placed upstairs in my bedroom. And my very first album that I actually won off the radio station was Prince, the one where he's there and he has his long, relaxed hair and his chest is out and he's singing, I want to be your lover. Like, wow, what is this? That was my very first vinyl album.
And you won it. Yay.
Yes.
Okay. You hitch up with this fella and you come down to Waynesboro.
Yeah.
And you start singing formally, you say, with a group.
Yeah.
What was that? Was it church?
No, never really church. You know, formally I was with a group called Fortune. It was a 4-piece. Myself, I had a lead guitarist, a drummer, bass player. They're all local folks.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first R&B type of band that I was in. Then I was like in a 3-piece group.
Were you playing gigs?
Yeah.
You playing in the garage? Where?
In my living room for a Fortune. I mean, you know, the drummer would bring his set in and in the living room. And my house is 1,001 square feet, so not very big. And at that time, I had 3 children. I now have 5 children. But at that time, I had 3 children, and one was a toddler, and I have pictures at home or her sitting on the drummer stool with the sticks, basically.
You got all these children running around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And practicing music, basically. And generally that occurred on the weekend primarily because we were all working adults. You fit it in where you can, basically.
Where were you working back then?
During the 90s, working at Woodrow Wilson.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what kind of work were you doing?
Secretarial work. Okay. Primarily, yeah. That's what I did for a while, secretarial type work.
Were you open about your background? Were
as far as?
Comfortable saying I was a homeless street kid in Boston?
I don't know. Comfortable. It's never a conversation that you really get into. I mean, I always tell my kids, look, I was homeless. You guys have it lucky. Yeah. You know, you guys have it good here. When I was your age, I was on my own. And so I never hesitated to tell anyone about, okay, this is what I've been through. But it's nothing that you really talk about to people unless you're close to them and things like that. So,
okay. All right. You're working. You're singing on the weekend with lots of kids running around. You got a husband now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then going to school as well. Education, still, I started UMass Boston in 1987, did that first year. Then I moved here. And I almost immediately started going to Blue Ridge Community College. I graduated from there with my associates in maybe 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on from there and graduated from an institution here in Harrisonburg area, Eastern Mennonite University. Got my bachelor's degree from there in the adult degree program in 2004.
What was driving you?
Education. I like to learn.
You like to learn.
Yeah.
Okay.
And education really has always been important to me. And it was certainly, especially someone that has been driven, has been taking care of themselves for a long time. Education, I see as the key to, you know, moving yourself forward up as far as, you know, being able to afford better things for your children and a better life and things like that. So I just continue to do that. With my last degree, I have a master's degree now. I got that in 2009. So
in what?
Community economic development. Again, outreach related stuff, because that really, again, is a part of me because of where I came from, being someone that was homeless, living in communities that were oftentimes impoverished. And so, again, just a giving back, basically, and helping others trying to find their way, whatever that is.
Because you've been there and done that.
Oh, yeah, been there and done that. And it's hard getting out. And you have to have help. You know, we get so stuck in, I did it all myself. No, you didn't. You're not doing anything by yourself. You're having some kind of help somewhere, whether it be your parents that are helping you along the way, whether it be some other person in the community helping you along the way. All of us get help doing something in our lives and moving forward. They're teaching us and they're getting us ready. So,
in the meantime, you're still singing?
Yeah.
And when did the still R&B?
No.
No.
I switched from R&B because with R&B, you need to have a band, basically. You really do need to have...
You got to have the pips. Gladys Knight wasn't anything without the pips.
You got to have, you know, a band, a drummer, and all this stuff. And it was just too much for me, specifically too much because, look, if I work 4 hours in that club and I make $25, then I got to split it between the four of you. And so we done spent 4 hours in that club and we made $25. And I got to split it with four of you. I mean, that's not enough money.
It's not. You're right.
In fact, that's just no damn money. That's no money.
All right. So you switched to?
I switched to blues music, basically. Again, just going back to blues music and really starting off again where I began with the blues, the women blues, or what they call the classic blues.
What's the first blues song you remember really working on, really making your own?
Gosh, I don't know. It took me a while to make, Martha, it took me a while to make blues my own. I started singing the blues, but I think there really is something to the fact that, okay, it's just, I started singing the blues the way I would sing R&B, and it's not right.
And now talk about that a little bit.
Well, R&B, I sang it more in a soprano voice.
Hey, do hum a little something.
I feel good, baby, I feel good all over. That's a higher type of voice. That's a song by Stephanie Mills, which was a great R&B artist of the 90s. But with blues, I find it works best in a lower register. You used to be sweet milk, but you done turned sour on me. And it took me a while to learn you're not going to sing blues in that R&B voice. It has a lot less power to it. I can remember coming again, being here in Virginia and being in a studio in the 90s, and I was singing that Bessie Smith song. I believe it was the Empty Bed Blues song, and I was singing it in that R&B voice. And the guy kept telling me, sing that like she sings it. Sing it over again. And I'm like, what are you talking about, dude? I'm singing it.
can you do it the way you were singing it and then as an R&B and then do it as a blues so we can hear the difference, that song?
You used to be sweet milk, but you done turned sour on me. You see, it's much more flowery, and it's not as powerful. It doesn't really convince you that you were my sweet milk, and, you know, it's not doing what it's supposed to do. But in that lower register, I can just really just do it and punch it out. And I didn't really get that at first when I started singing the blues. It took me a number of years to actually get that.
And when you got it, did you feel, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did you feel as though
it's liberating?
Yeah, that you were coming home musically?
I think so. I feel free with singing the blues. the blues is much more sassier than rhythm and blues. I mean, just those lyrics, those metaphoric lyrics, is humorous, and that certainly fits my personality. And then again, the voice, I have the vocal range where I can kind of play with it.
You've got a huge range, I think.
I just have to kind of use it. I've been figuring out, wow, I have to kind of vary it, the range, my use of my range. But I discovered that lower range, and really my lower range is much more powerful than my soprano range now.
And you've studied the blues. I mean, you've studied singing seriously, right? Done some workshops, done some workshops, done whatever.
Well, I
worked with Sapphire.
Well, actually not. I worked with Gay Adegbolola of Sapphire, the Up Blues Women, after they retired. In fact, most recently in 2012, I served as her apprentice from September 2012 to May 2013 via the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the Folklife, the Virginia Folklife, headed by John Lohman.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite incredible. I had been seeing Sapphire, the Uppity Blues Women, around and had gone to a couple of their concerts. The last one that they had in Charlottesville in particular was the one, one of the ones that I last remember seeing them at. And then I went to Augusta Blues Week. Now, I had been knowing about Augusta Blues Week for a while. In fact, the founder of the Blues Week portion of it, Joan Fenton, had told me about it years ago. And I just never, I'm having kids, working, I can't afford, to go away for a week or whatever. But I went the first time 3 years ago, and that's where I took Gay Adegbolola's class in vocals, basically.
Where is Augusta Blues Week?
It is in West Virginia at the, I always get this wrong, Elkins and Davis or Davis and Elkins College.
Okay.
Forgive me. I always get them switched up. and so I actually did that. And from there, I experienced her vocal class. And she talked about, how singing, can be liberating, basically. And she's right, because so many times, at least for me, I suffer from stage fright. And you wouldn't
You're
know
kidding
it. People
me.
Say,
yeah,
I don't know. I wouldn't have even known that. Well, yeah, I have a huge amount of stage fright, and it limits me. I mean, I think it limits me in my interaction with the audience, basically. And so we worked a little bit on that once we had
stop
our...
stop that.
I know.
You had no reason to have it.
I mean, really. I think it's... I suffer from stage fright, I think, because I'm a type A personality. I want some control. And with music, when you put yourself out there and you're on stage, you don't have any control. You're vulnerable. And so it's like, wow, I got to get it right. I can't miss a word. I can't miss a beat. And then I think eventually, that has decreased for me as I've gotten older. It's really a lot of, being much more comfortable with yourself and not really putting that type of thing as a priority. Like, it's not all that important that, you have to be in control of everything. You're not going to die if you miss a word. The world is not going to end. You shall go on and no one will notice. I mean, really, it really is true. The non-musicians do not notice your flubs. Now, the musicians will notice your flubs when you've gone off key or whatever. But, no one else is paying attention. They're in the groove.
Do you read music?
No.
No. You do it by ear?
Yes.
Okay. Do you practice?
I do practice. Generally, when I get with a guitarist, because, again, I'm not an instrumentalist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm strictly a vocalist. I dabble a little in trying to play guitar. In fact, that's one of the things that during my apprenticeship, Gay said, "Hey, you need to be able to accompany yourself." And she's right, I do. But I don't think I'll ever get to that point. I don't have the patience. I don't have the time.
How old are your kids?
My kids, I still have two minor kids at home. My youngest is 9.
Wow.
Yeah, and my oldest is 28.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just don't have a lot of time to sit down, and I take guitar lessons right now, and I've been taking guitar lessons from Rob Otis over in Waynesboro off and on since the 90s. So that's how long I've been.
We do what we can do in this life, you know? Okay.
Wait a minute.
Are you ambitious with your singing at all? I mean, do you gig?
Yeah, I gig.
Where you gig?
Here's my common answer: where I can get paid. Although I do some freebies. In fact, I'm doing a gig tonight, basically over in Afton, Virginia, for my children's school. It's a fundraiser, basically.
What's the school?
North Branch School.
Oh.
Over in Afton. Mm-hmm.
I love North Branch.
Mm-hmm. So we do commonly, well, maybe once or twice a year, do a freebie for a nonprofit of our choice or mm-hmm. a cause that we believe in. But generally, I like to get paid because mm-hmm. it takes time. I mean, really, if you practice with someone every weekend and you're there at their house 2-3 hours, and you're practicing your songs, you're learning new songs, you're arranging new songs, whatever. That's time and effort. But unfortunately, there's little pay out there.
Are you ambitious with your singing? I mean, do you have dreams or are you got to be a very practical person with the life that you've had, you know, but do you have dreams?
I would say that I've spent a lot of my life pushing that away out of fear that, okay, Lori, you can't live off this singing thing. I mean, here you are, you have 5 kids, you know, most of that time spending trying to educate yourself, going part-time to school, just to improve your working condition. And from what I can see, this doesn't pay the bills. Working musicians in blues genres don't make a lot of money. I mean, perhaps they could make what, as I understand, what I make on a yearly basis working my day job. I think I read somewhere that this particular artist made like $40,000+ a year once they took out all of their expenses, this, that. Of course, they've traveled around the world. They've got to meet different people. They lived the life of a musician, and they brought home $40,000+ a
year.
And
you're practical.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, well, maybe I could do that for a while, but, and in blues music, again, I am in my mid-40s, so you don't suffer for being older, I think. In fact, I love the story of Sapphire to Uppity Blues women. They went out on the road in their 40s. Yeah. After their children graduated from high school, I believe the story is Ann Rapson said, "Hey, I'm going out on the road. Do you want to go with me?" You know, and Gay said, "Okay, I'm going to go with you." And the other person that I can't think of her name because it is not the Andra Faye is the person I'm thinking of, but it wasn't Andra Faye. It was another person. And so, you know, they went out on the road in their 40s after their children left home. I still have children at home.
But you think life is long and it's possible?
I think it's possible.
Would you like it?
I think I would like it. I would give it a shot. I think I have the chops for sure.